Hello everyone, and welcome to the Ecosystemic Futures Podcast. I'm your host, Marco Annunziata, and I'm excited to introduce my co-host, Chris Potter, and today's guest, international environmental policy expert, Jesse Reynolds. Chris, Jess, welcome. I'm excited for our discussion on the governance of solar geoengineering. Now, before we dive in, I'd love to have you both take a quick moment to introduce yourselves to our audience. Chris, why don't you go first?
Sure, Marco. My name is Dr. Christopher Potter. I'm a earth scientist at NASA, posted at the Ames Research Center in Silicon Valley, California. I've worked for 30 years for NASA doing climate change research and using satellite imagery to monitor the Earth, and have many different projects peripherally related to global climate change and solar geoengineering.
So the audience understands why you're here on the podcast as co-host, Chris. Thanks very much. Jesse.
Thanks for having me on the podcast. I am a researcher and policy advisor in the area of environment, technology, and international policy, and have been for roughly the last 25 years. Most of this work has been focused on emerging technologies to address climate change. This includes solar geoengineering, which we'll discuss today. My work has included, for example, I authored a book, The Governance of Solar Geoengineering, a couple years ago on Cambridge University Press. Another hat I wear is, like you, I host a podcast, Challenging Climate. And my day job is I'm executive secretary of a project called the Climate Overshoot Commission. And it's important to say that I'm here today in my personal capacity and that my views do not represent those of the commission or the secretariat of the commission.
So I mirror your excitement about today's topic, Marco. It's a topic that's been I've been following for quite some time, but it's not without some controversy. So what exactly is solar geoengineering and why is it controversial? Solar geoengineering is an approach designed to cool the Earth by reflecting sunlight back into space and or modifying clouds. And it's intended to limit or reverse human-caused climate change. And while solar geoengineering has the potential to help counteract global warming, many in the climate science community have voiced concern about the possibility of unintended consequences, risks, namely the unwanted effects on rainfall or other global weather patterns. The White House in Washington has set into motion a 5-year outline for research into climate change, leveraging methods of solar geoengineering. The debate over just how much we should meddle with the climate and climate change is likely to intensify as the fallout from global heating worsens. There's a lot to unpack here. So, Jesse, can we just dive in? You've been researching climate change and social geoengineering and solar geoengineering for nearly 30 years. So the public debate on climate change has focused on limiting greenhouse gas emissions, right? Isn't that enough? Why do we need to do geoengineering too?
Well, thanks for the question. It's important to emphasize that in the long run, cutting emissions, heading towards global net zero emissions, is the only long-term solution to climate change. But it turns out that cutting emissions rapidly, especially the emissions of carbon dioxide, the most important greenhouse gas, is really difficult. It's tied intimately to economic activity, which in turn is what's lifting the world's poor out of poverty, reducing child mortality, increasing education, etc. And we must not belittle the real benefits of economic activity and access to energy. Carbon dioxide accumulates in the atmosphere. If we reduce it now, what we emitted last year and the years before is still there. So we have this sort of stock and flow problem. Cutting emissions is a collective action problem where everybody kind of wants to drag their feet and hope that the rest of the world does a good job. And then the benefits of costly emissions cuts go to the future, whereas the costs are borne by the present. So it's really a difficult problem. And we're now in a situation where we're at 1.1 degrees Celsius warming. The climate world uses Celsius. Apologies to American listeners for that. And the IPCC, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, the UN body that's tasked with assessing the risks of climate change and how we're doing in that regard has said that it's almost inevitable that we're going to cross 1.5 degrees Celsius warming. That's the more ambitious side of the goals set out in the Paris Agreement, the leading international instrument for combating climate change. And other experts agree, and that crossing of 1.5 will probably happen in the next 10 years or so. And if you ask experts, especially if you ask them anonymously, they tend to say, well, we're probably going to head to around 3 degrees warming by the end of this century, so at 2100. So it's important to look at the full range of tools that we may have access to reduce the risks of climate change. Adapting to a changed climate has always been part of international climate change policy, and it's been moving up the agenda, especially at the urging of those who are most vulnerable to climate change. But that's also a slow problem, and it's expensive. There's been increasing talk about removing carbon dioxide from the atmosphere, which just confused matters. Sometimes gets lumped into the geoengineering basket. I generally don't lump it in there. And that can help. That can reduce net emissions. And in the long run, it's going to be needed to clean up the mess we've made because, as I said, CO2, carbon dioxide, lingers in the atmosphere. But given this context that we're going to almost inevitably pass these thresholds, these goals that we've set for ourselves through instruments such as the Paris Agreement, it might be the case that solar geoengineering may be able to reduce the worst symptoms of climate change, ideally a little bit and temporarily until we can reduce atmospheric greenhouse gas concentrations back to a safe level.
Thanks, Jesse. And as an economist, I'm especially happy that you've brought up the issue of the economic cost of reducing greenhouse emissions and the very unpleasant trade-offs with the real social and economic and health costs that that implies, which is a very strong argument for considering a multi-pronged approach. So with this background, why don't you take us back to the basics and tell us a bit, how does the solar geoengineering actually work?
So solar geoengineering could be described as blocking or otherwise reflecting a small portion of incoming sunlight in order to cool the planet with the objective of countering climate change. And to be clear, this would be a very small portion, something like maybe 1% of incoming sunlight. And there's a handful of methods under consideration. The one that receives the most attention, and justifiably so, is called a stratospheric aerosol injection. As the name implies, it would introduce small particles, aerosol particles, kind of like super small dust that would float up in the stratosphere. And very much like a smoggy day that we've had in big cities at a lower elevation, it blocks a small portion of the incoming sunlight. Well, if it's up in the stratosphere, those particles have the advantage that they would linger for 6 months or a year. So you would need to inject less than if you were to do it at a lower altitude. It would need to be a somewhat continuous process. And we know that this would work, stratospheric aerosol injection, as the leading proposed method of solar geoengineering, because this is what volcanoes do. That's the inspiration. Large volcanoes inject all sorts of dust and rocks into the atmosphere, but among this material is very small particles. Some of it gets into the stratosphere, and big eruptions like Mount Pinatubo in 1991 will cool the planet for a year. So there's not much question about whether it would cool the climate. As I mentioned, there are a couple of other proposals. I should briefly mention the second leading proposal is called marine cloud brightening. Its mechanism of action is a little bit more complicated, but basically it would seek to make those dark, low-lying clouds that we've seen over the ocean brighter by introducing more solids for the water to grab onto. Smaller particles makes smaller droplets of water, which is brighter. And those particles could be something as simple as spraying up seawater, and then the resulting salt lingering in the air gives something for the water to grab onto, and you'd have white clouds. But this is a little uncertain about how much cooling you could get. Whereas with stratospheric aerosol injection, it's clear that we could get as much cooling as we would ever need.
Let me just make a quick comment and follow-up question on this, Jesse, because there's a very interesting point. You noted that the technology would reflect a tiny portion of sunlight back into space, about 1%, I think you said.
Yeah.
But it's still something that would have a meaningful impact in terms of potentially cooling the planet. So I think there's an interesting point there on the sensitivities and of the fine-tuning of the intervention.
Precisely. It can be thought of as a control problem for those who have an engineering mindset about how we could learn to influence a system that we don't precisely have calibrated beforehand.
It's a great discussion so far. I wanted to follow up on all that by asking, since there are risks involved, of course, how effective do you think it could be compared to other possible actions that may have, less risk?
Yeah, as I said, it's clear that reducing and eliminating greenhouse gas emissions will prevent climate change. And removing carbon dioxide from the atmosphere is more or less equivalent, climatically speaking, to turning the clock back. Solar geoengineering would not turn the clock back perfectly. Numerous modeling studies show that a moderate intensity of solar geoengineering introduced across the world in a fairly consistent way. You don't want big differences. You don't want a spotty world. You don't want the level of solar geoengineering going up and down rapidly. But something fairly well controlled would certainly reduce temperature. It would reduce temperature extremes, and a moderate dose would also bring back many of the local changes in precipitation patterns back towards pre-industrial levels. Some other things that make solar geoengineering interesting are that it would be very rapidly effective. So an introduction of stratospheric aerosols or brightening marine clouds would be climatically felt within a few months, which gives it a very interesting potential complementary role to the slower but more important effect of eliminating greenhouse gases. It would be reversible, which is kind of a two-sided coin. If we decide we're doing too much solar geo, we can dial it down and reach a new equilibrium within a few months. It also means that we would need to maintain it for a long time or slowly ramp it down. It couldn't be, if it were to be stopped suddenly, we would have severe climatic impacts. It looks technically feasible. There's no clear barriers to, for example, introducing a few megatons of aerosols into the stratosphere. And another interesting aspect is that it's really inexpensive in climate change terms. So we're looking at, studies have pointed to a few billions of dollars per year to roll out solar geoengineering, which is not nothing, to be clear, but climate change economics often quickly gets into the trillions of dollars when you're talking about impacts or very aggressive emissions cuts. In fact, if anything, solar geoengineering looks too cheap, right? We don't need to reduce the cost. That's not a barrier here. So the question in terms of, is it effective? It's yes, but it can be thought of best as a palliative or an analgesic, a type of a medicine that temporarily suppresses some of the worst symptoms while a cure is being researched and implemented.
That's very interesting, Jesse, because from the description you've just given us, it sounds like solar geoengineering it's a palliative, as you said, but it's one that is effective. It's a rapid intervention, and it's relatively inexpensive compared to others. It almost makes you wonder, why are we not doing it already? Which leads me to my next question, which is, what are in your mind and your experience the main uncertainties, the risks, the possible unintended consequences we should think about as we consider the deployment of solar geoengineering?
That's essential to approaching this and understanding why, in fact, it's not moved up the agenda of climate change discussions earlier and more rapidly. A logical place to start is, what are the climatic risks? Well, as I said, a moderate, consistent dose of solar geoengineering looks like it would dial most climate change aspects, extreme precipitation, extreme heat, average temperature back. There are concerns that as you approach compensating global warming entirely, so instead of a moderate dose, you fully cool the planet, 2 degrees warming, 2 degrees cooling, where are you at? You have some significant changes in by differences in heat across land and ocean, and solar geoengineering would be imperfect. It would act different than the opposite of carbon dioxide. It's not quite the opposite of carbon dioxide. You can look at secondary environmental impacts. For example, we know that the material that volcanoes inject into the stratosphere, which is sulfur, various sulfates, sulfur dioxide ends up as a type of sulfuric acid droplet, catalyzes the destruction of stratospheric ozone, which provides a protective layer against incoming ultraviolet light. Models show that stratospheric aerosol injection with sulfates would slow down the recovery of stratospheric ozone, which in the 20th century humans were depleting unintentionally through various chemicals being released. So that doesn't look like a deal breaker, but more research is needed. But the real challenges come when you start looking at the governance and political questions, which inevitably overlap with the environmental impacts. I've spoken about this moderate, consistent dose of solar geoengineering. What if it's not moderate? What if it's injected, stratospheric aerosols are put into one hemisphere but not the other? What if it's dialed up too fast? What if it's dialed down too slow? You could have really climate impacts. And even then, from a political perspective, if it's inexpensive, if it looks inexpensive and it looks technically feasible and it looks climatically effective, there's concern about someone who's interested in doing it going too far, too fast ahead of the international consensus. And even if there is a consensus, you can add material to the atmosphere, but not really take it out. So the country or whatever that wanted the most, that greatest intensity of solar geoengineering could end up getting its way. You can imagine some difficult international politics playing out, as well as blame for extreme weather events that may or may not have anything to do with solar geoengineering, because, of course, political leaders like to shift blame for domestic problems to outsiders when possible. And the most influential concern and the most difficult to confront is that attention to solar geoengineering research, development, and possible use would distract attention from the essential efforts to reduce and eventually eliminate greenhouse gas emissions.
That's a great point, and we ought to unpack that a little bit more because I know there a lot of scientists are saying just that. But I want to go a little deeper into this issue of governance, Jesse. How might we govern, given our current frameworks, you know, under climate negotiations, both, you know, the deployment, the rollout, and then eventually the maintenance of solar geoengineering? Do we have frameworks in place that we could depend on?
Yes and no. I'm going to modify your question just a touch and first broaden the conversation to think about governance broadly of solar geoengineering broadly. So we can think about steering early stage research and development into responsible directions. Sure, we have bodies such as the National Academies of Science in the U.S. and elsewhere that can start to develop, for example, best practices. But the real tough questions are around what you talk about, like who might decide whether this should be used, what breadth of consensus is necessary, how do we resolve disputes in this space? And it's important to bear in mind, we're not going in with a blank slate. There's this diversity of international institutions that are some of which are very legal in nature, such as international law and treaties. And we have institutions for dialogue, such as the United Nations. But it's really unclear where that conversation will happen. I mean, the good news is there's legal rules, such as something like the customary international law of transboundary harm, which is sort of like a widely shared belief that there are legally obligated requirements to reduce and even environmental risks that cross boundaries. So there's a baseline there. There's existing agreements like the UN Convention on the Law of the Sea or the Convention on Biological Diversity that provide some grounding there. But it looks like there's not any clear place for decision making. So as we start thinking about decision making, often the first question or the first challenge that I put forward is there's always a trade-off in contentious international negotiations between depth, how strong the commitment is, and breadth of participation, how many countries you get. Because international law is consensual. If a country doesn't want to participate, it doesn't. There's a couple of exceptions to that that don't really apply here, but around like, you know, genocide and so forth. But for the most part, that's the case. So you want to be careful that if you strive too hard for a rule that says you can't use solar geoengineering without the consent of this body, then those countries that are most interested in using solar geoengineering, which might be superpowers, or it might be climate vulnerable small island states, we don't know. It could be troublemakers. Right, the usual cast of characters now, which may or may not be the same in a couple decades, those are going to be the countries that are going to be most reluctant to join into such an agreement. So you got to think really carefully. If we really want those countries that are capable and interested in using solar geo, we need to offer them an agreement that's in their interest to sign up to. That's a tough question.
I was smiling as you were talking, Jesse, because I was thinking to myself, oh boy, this is really not the best of times for international policy cooperation overall. We've seen a rise in populism, in nationalism. So this challenge really comes at an awkward time. And also, if it's such a high-stakes game, an existential question almost, this could play both ways, right? It could strengthen the incentive for countries to come together. But it could also, as you were hinting at, create a situation where what we see instead is more countries going their own way and saying, well, this is too important. I can't wait for consensus to be formed. I will move forward by myself. Speaking of which, in December, we heard the story of one entrepreneur running a live trial of their solar and geoengineering solution. I think, in fact, Jesse, if I'm not mistaken, you had him on your podcast following that. And this has generated quite a bit of controversy. Some have called it an early foray into climate activism, but a lot of the discussion has been exactly on the idea that we might have actions taken unilaterally by a few with the potential to affect many. And it's also one example of the private sector jumping in where governments are still feeling their way around and holding discussions and committees. Now, I think you've said, and we can probably agree, that this specific event had very little real impact. But what can we learn from this in our effort to understand how to design for ecosystem wellness and what this single episode might portend for the solar geoengineering efforts in particular?
I take away two primary lessons. One is that it reinforces, I think, what many observers already knew, and that is that solar geoengineering is a contentious enough topic. Politically, it raises a lot of concerns, some of which are very legitimate, some of which I find to be poorly informed and poorly reasoned, but they're there nevertheless. And this project, it was a startup, called itself Make Sunsets, and they said that they would launch small balloons that would go up to the stratosphere and release a small dose of what they hoped would be an aerosol that they hoped would reflect, and that they would sell this as a type of a cooling credit. This was a recipe. It was like a checklist of everything to do wrong. No real engagement with science, scientists, no transparency, no engagement with local officials and communities, a for-profit business model that really invited those who might be investing in cutting emissions and removing greenhouse gases to say, well, instead I can do this cheap and feel like I'm cooling the planet and countering climate change, or maybe tell my customers that I am. I guess that depends upon how cynical one is. It really reinforces that this needs to proceed carefully at typical research institutions like universities, through typical funding mechanisms from governments and major philanthropies, in ways that are transparent, in ways that are not for profit, etc. I think there's a second high-level lesson that I take away from this, and this looks at the political dynamic. The opponents of solar geoengineering research point to this incident, and they say, see, we told you so. This is just a path that inevitably goes down the road of numerous undesirable characteristics, most of all in avoiding greenhouse gas emissions reduction. But when we asked the founder of this firm what motivated him, was he said, well, research isn't happening. And I look at these field tests that have been of small-scale field tests by legitimate university-based researchers that have been canceled. And it frustrates me. There's been no real major field tests of even the equipment of stratospheric aerosol injection, despite a decade of conversation. Why haven't those gone forward? Well, it turns out that the opponents of solar geoengineering have managed to stop these field experiments, saying it crosses a Rubicon, that this will legitimize something that we first need a global dialogue about. And you can see how it's the extremes feeding off of each other, with the loser in this process being the generation of knowledge and trust that will be essential if solar geoengineering might be able to reduce climate change risks in the future, especially to the most vulnerable populations in the world.
That's such an interesting answer to the question. We all like great sunsets, but I guess it's sometimes not the way to do it, not worth the benefit of visually. But so I guess, kind of coming to the end of the interview here, where do we go from here, Jesse? I mean, specifically, I guess I'd like to throw in one more question is, do you see any changes, any trends in the way people, general public, are starting to either embrace or reject the concept of solar geoengineering?
I do think that, I'm confident that over the years I've been following this issue since about 2009 or so, that solar geoengineering has more attention, which is understandable because greenhouse gas concentrations continue to rise, emissions cuts continue to be insufficient. And it makes sense that as that continues, interest in a wider range of tools increases. That the tone of the conversation challenges me. I find it difficult. There's a certain polarization that I think has created a stalemate. And there's unfortunately a lot of misinformation circulating around solar geo. And I don't just mean the conspiracy theories that these are spraying chemicals in the sky that allow the World Economic Forum to control what we consume and make us into mindless TV watchers and McDonald's buyers or whatever. I don't keep up with that too closely. But I mean misinformation around the science of solar geoengineering, where statements get repeated so much that they take on a life of their own. And this is tough. This is tough. It's not entirely unlike where climate change itself was 20 years ago, where there's a political constituency that uses to confront the evidence and engage with that honestly. So I wish I could be a bit more confident and optimistic about the tone of the discourse, but unfortunately I can't. I think I'll go ahead and tackle your first question, which in a way is a good way to wrap up, and that's, where do we go from here? As I say, interest is increasing, funding is gradually increasing for solar geoengineering. There will be a proposal coming out of the White House Office of Science and Technology Policy for what a modest federal research program might look like. We're looking at something on the order of $10 million, $20 million per year, which in research budgets is small. But it's important to remember that solar geoengineering globally is running around $25 million per year. It's a really small area of climate change research, like a half of 1% of climate change research. So this could give it a nice boost. Ideally, research would internationalize. It's a little too U.S.-centric right now, and that's not just a problem of concentration. The U.S. isn't perceived in the best light in the international climate change arena due to inconsistent policy. There are processes in intergovernmental organizations toward stronger, wider dialogues on the issue. UNESCO, a UN agency for education, science, and culture, has a process about the ethics of geoengineering. The UN General Assembly might discuss or at least consider the issue this fall. And consider is a term of art in this area where it means do something, which could just be, you know, kick it to a later event. I think a piece that's missing that I'd really like to see is authoritative international scientific assessment of solar geoengineering. What do we know? And there's been individual reports, for example, coming from the U.S. National Academies, in particular in 2015. Not only is that 8 years ago, but again, we need international to build trust. And I'd hope that the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, the IPCC, takes this up. It didn't really tackle this in a substantive way in its most recent comprehensive assessment report, which came out over the last year and a half or so. There's a possibility it could take on a special report, which it alternates big assessment reports and then a group of special reports. I think that could be a great development. If not the IPCC, then some other agency could take that along. And ideally, these pieces start to slowly come together where we have more research, more assessment of research so that we can synthesize the thousands of scientific papers, more dialogues to build trust, and ideally laying the foundation for thinking carefully about governance and decision-making around these really hard questions.
That's an excellent and very concrete call for action, which is a great way to wrap up our discussion. I have to say, Jesse, I love conspiracy theories in general, but I don't think it takes chemicals in the sky to make all of us hopelessly and mindlessly addicted to our smartphones and the various other screens. I think that's one conspiracy theory too far, probably. But thanks both, Chris, Jesse, for a great discussion. As I think of how we've spent the last half hour, for me, probably the biggest takeaway is the following. It's that it seems easy to dismiss solar geoengineering as something which is perhaps far-fetched, perhaps too risky and too ripe with unintended consequences. But to me, it becomes almost like a reality check and a call for all of us to think, how worried are we really about climate change? Because if we do believe that climate change is an imminent existential risk, then it would be irresponsible to take off the table any option, including options that might appear more uncertain and riskier, like solar geoengineering. So for me, that's probably the biggest takeaway of our discussion. Chris, how about you?
I have similar thoughts along those lines, but one of the takeaways that I came away with was, if the U.S. government is going to get into this and federal research is going to be ramped up in the area, it has pretty big implications, I think, for my colleagues at NASA, because, you know, we have some of the best climate stratospheric scientists in the world. And so it's going to be an opportunity for our scientists to, you know, to work on this. And it's a perfect, you know, nexus between aviation, aeronautics, and earth science. We rarely get those opportunities to get out of our silos. And that, so it really helps us to broaden our thinking this way as scientists.
It's an excellent point. There's so much more we could discuss, but Jesse, thank you so much for joining us this afternoon, for sharing your insights, your perspectives. As a reminder to our audience, please be sure to check out Jesse's podcast. Again, it's called Challenging Climate, and you can find it pretty much everywhere you find your podcast feeds. So check it out. You'll find a lot more insights on science, technology, and the politics of climate change. The link to the podcast will also be included on our profile page. Before we close, Jesse, I want to give the opportunity back to you one last time. What's the one piece of advice that you would like our listeners to come away from this discussion?
To some degree, this will echo what you said a moment ago, Marco, and that is, those who are most concerned about climate change would agree that efforts to prevent and reduce have benefited by taking a rational approach, confronting the evidence at hand, weighing off the serious trade-offs, and coming to the conclusion that as inconvenient as the truth may be, the risks of climate change are real and warrant aggressive emissions cuts. Likewise, there's other inconvenient truths that global warming looks like it will exceed the goals that we've set in the Paris Agreement, and that solar geoengineering may be able to reduce climate change. So it requires understanding the risks and the potential benefits in the context of a world where there's no first best, there's only second bests.
I couldn't agree more. I think the world of second bests and difficult choices that this brings up, couldn't describe it any better. So let's end on this, you know, hard but constructive note. Jesse, Chris, thanks both of you again for joining us today. And everybody, please stay tuned for next week's episode.